Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, looking at photographs with Jeff Dyer and his new book, Seesaw.
Jeff Dyer is the author of 10 non-fiction books and 4 novels. He has won the Somerset Maugham Prize, the Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction, a Lannan Literary Award, the International Centre of Photography's 2006 Infinity Award for Writing on Photography, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters E.M. Forster Award. In 2012, he won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and in 2015, he received the Wyndham Campbell Prize for Nonfiction. His books have been translated into 24 languages. He currently lives in Los Angeles, where he's a writer-in-residence at the University of Southern California. But today I'm talking to Jeff in London, not Los Angeles, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Seesaw, Looking at Photographs. Jeff, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
This is the latest in a series of books, I say a series, over your career, a series of books on photography. So how does this one relate to your previous photography books?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's, I was thinking, oh, great, that's a simple question. And then as soon as I start formulating the answer, I realize it's a little bit more complicated. So about every 10 years, I tend to put together a book of the essays that I've written in the previous 10 years, essays on everything. And in the last one of these that I did, Working the Room, that started with a section on photography, but then there were also sections of, literary criticism and writing on music and all this kind of stuff. Okay, so that came out about 10 years ago. And then as I started to look through my files for the latest 10 years worth of, stuff, which I know the world had been so eagerly awaiting, I was disturbed to find that actually it was a really skimpy file. And I thought, oh my God, I really haven't written much. But the reason for that, I realized, is because actually there was another file stuffed full of all the stuff that I'd written in the last 10 years just on photography. So it seemed to me that what had happened is that, yeah, I'd just kind of become a bit more of a devoting more time to writing about photography. So that's how it stands in relation to the general collections of essays. And then in terms of photography books, I mean, there were those essays on photography in the essay books, but there was also the long book about photography, The Ongoing Moment, which sketched a kind of tradition of photography. And then a couple of years ago, there was that one-off book that I did about Gary Winogrand, a photographer that means so much to me. And then this is things that I've done, which have either maybe, I'm either dealing with canonical figures who I didn't write about at all in The Ongoing Moment, such as Alvin Langdon Coburn, for example, or more contemporary figures for the most part, who I got asked to write about or whose work I saw and felt sufficiently moved by to write something about them.
Tell us something about what looking at photographs means to you, then, what you derive from it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where the question contains its answer in a way. I mean, it's a book about photographs, and yeah, what do I do with photographs? Well, I just look at them, really, and I don't have any axe to grind, and I don't have a particular method, but I think it's probably my way of doing it is very similar to anybody's, really, that, you know, you're reading the paper or a magazine and a photograph just catches your eye and you think, oh, that's an interesting picture. And you spend either more or less time, you know, looking at it and thinking about it. And then I think, so that, you know, there's that sometimes an individual image is interesting in its own right. But then I think it becomes really quite interesting when you maybe come across another image randomly and you realize, oh, that's by the same person whose work, you know, I saw a picture that I liked a little while ago. And then I think it becomes, you come back very rapidly, always in photography, to that question, which I think one can put very simply, you know, is it who by or is it what of? Because quite often it'll turn out that a picture might be of something that's quite interesting, but the way in which it's captured, rendered, or whatever the word might be, is quite distinct to one particular person. And it's really, it's that thing which I think has fascinated many of us who've written about photography for so long, the way that this impersonal instrument, the camera, can be a way not only of offering a documentary record of an event, but that documentary record is, as it were, water stamped or shot through with the stylistic or conceptual DNA of the person working the camera.
And you say you don't really have a method, but as you explained in the book, of course, we are really all, we're all schooled in the in the sort of the general critical methods of, I guess, you know, the 20th century in terms of looking at images.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would say there's nothing. I'd say this. I think there is a kind of rigor at work and an intensity of looking that the writers I like best bring to photography. So, of course, I'm thinking overwhelmingly of John Berger in that regard, who was such an important part of my life. But I think in common with Berger, I think there's nothing at all academic about the way that I write about photography or about anything for that matter. But, you know, I do have a great tendency to become very, very interested in things. So I think, although if you were an academic, you might be talking, you know, you might have areas of research. I don't tend to have that, but I do tend to have things that particularly interest me, so I can spend an awful long time finding out more about them. And quite often I think the essays record, if you like, the journey by which I've been able to satisfy my own curiosity about either a given image or the photographer who's created a whole number of images.
At this latter stage, the 21st century, we're so saturated with images, you know, whether that's magazines or multiple television channels or pornography, which is something you talk about in the book at one point, or, you know, latterly Instagram and other types of TikTok and, you know, social media type image producing products. Do you think this changes how we view photography, how we consume photography as an art form?
Yeah, I mean, it undoubtedly has done, although it's a change that maybe hasn't affected me so much because I'm not on any social media at all. So my exposure to these things is quite limited. So even something like, you know, Instagram, lots of great pictures on Instagram, and I only tend to come across them, not directly, but because some photographer friend has referred them to me. So they've gone through some kind of filtering, or I'll there'll be those things in The Guardian that, you know, they do their best pictures of the year, best pictures of the month, best pictures of the week, you know, and you could probably even refine it down to the best pictures of the minute. But even when I was doing that column for The New Republic called Exposure, once a month I'd pick a news image that I particularly liked. And it became obvious to me very early on when I started doing this that I could get completely consumed, spending my whole life just trying to find the one image I was going to write about. So I very quickly managed to delegate that part of it to one of the editors at the magazine. And I said, just send me the sort of 20 best, you know, what you think are the most interesting, because I really don't want to start drowning in that image ocean, which used to be an image reservoir, but now is this complete planet-consuming body of stuff.
So we're going to go through some of the photographs that you look at and talk about in the book. Obviously, you know, I understand the irony of talking about photographs on the radio, but all of these photographs are reproduced in Jeff's book, which obviously you should buy. And you mentioned Alvin Langdon Coburn, and I want to talk about, first of all, about you actually start off in the book with a photograph of Paris, but then reproduce this photograph of London Bridge from 1904 by Alvin Langdon Coburn.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about why you chose this photo in particular. The first thing to say about this photograph, I mean, of course, obviously it's from 1904, although 1904 is, you know, relatively late in the history of photography. It seems like a very old photograph, but it's not that old in the history of photography. And it's the first thing one notices about it is it's very blurred and indistinct.
Mm. Yeah, well, to address several of those points, you're absolutely right that it's. I think the interesting thing about Coburn and that picture is that it comes both early and late in the tradition of photography. I mean, we think of him as somebody, you know, who's there right at the beginning. But, and this is where the title of the book comes from, actually, if you imagine 1904 as a date in terms of the whole history of photography, it's pretty much at the midpoint, actually, chronologically, even though, I mean, in terms of how long photography had been around, even though the number of really important figures before Alvin Langdon Coburn wasn't that extensive. And even though probably more pictures have been taken today than had been taken, you know, in all of the years between the invention of photography and Alvin Langdon Coburn doing that. And yeah, it's very, very blurry. And Coburn is an interesting figure, I think, in that he's very caught up in this idea of making, you know, making photography an art form. And one of the ways in which various people had tried to make their photographs look like art was to make them look painterly, which tended to be to make them look blurry. And there's all sorts of, you know, we can think of all sorts of examples of people doing that. Edward Steichen's work, very, very blurry, and some of the early Stieglitz work, this kind of thing of pictorialists. And I think he's so interesting, Coburn, because on the one hand, he's very sort of forward looking. But yeah, he's really into that blurry thing. And I think the one of the crucial sort of moments comes in the development of photography just a few years later when, as Paul Strand says, I think he says that, you know, Stieglitz persuaded him to remove the blurriness, that the sort of the fogginess from his pictures. And Stieglitz's importance, I think, is that he insists that no, there's no real need for photographs, for photography to try to pass itself off as something other than what it is, that photography is sufficiently strong as a thing in its own right. And there we get this kind of development of the greater insistence on a clarity of image, as opposed to going for some poetic, painterly blurriness. And in fairness to Coburn, he actually, he's interesting in a way because he then moves into a very sort of a different kind of idea of painterliness. He moves into the kind of territory we associate with vorticism or something like that.
And it's also interesting that you do look at this photograph of London and think, yeah, that's probably what it looked like at that point.
Yeah, except I suppose it was a bit foggy because the air quality wasn't quite as good. But I think it would be a lot clearer than it appears in this image. But, you know, there's all sorts of reasons for that, the extended exposure times that you need in order to get a clear image. And that's why the body of water that we see under the bridge has got this, you know, it's got this kind of murky quality. But yeah, it's both a very, very strong image. And I think these two things, London and New York, are really quite striking books. And yeah, that was, by the way, that was an example of something where somebody said to me, did I want to write this thing about Coburn? And I thought, oh, yeah, let's find out about, you know, what does Coburn really look like today to me?
The next one I wanted to talk about briefly, and mainly because I think this is my favourite photograph in the book, is the Greta Garbo poster in Paris by Elsa Bing. Mm. If you would just describe what this photograph looks like,
Corey. Yeah, sure thing. So it's a picture of one of those a wall in Paris with a picture of a fading, decaying photograph of Greta Garbo. It's kind of palimpsest in that bits of the original poster of Garbo still survive, but the wall is starting to show through it, and the top half of her face has entirely disappeared. So I think one of the things about this is that, well, what's it about? Well, two things, very obviously. It's about time, which is, of course, all photographs are about time. And it's also about the image, you know, the way that an image survives, the way that actually somebody like Greta Garbo herself existed in terms of her image. So it seems to me it's one of these things. It's a very, very simple image. And it's just got, it seems to me, to have it in concentrated form, quite a lot of what photography is about. I should say that it was taken in 1932, and it's, I don't know, I can't remember offhand how long it's taken for the poster to decay and disintegrate like that. It's almost like what we're seeing is a reverse of the process by which the image emerges in the developing tray. We're seeing the image fading away into the wall on which it's been pasted.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Jeff Dyer, and we're talking about his new book, Cecil, Looking at Photographs. And Jeff, you talk in the book about the rediscovered, or I say rediscovered, the discovered photographer Vivian Mayer. I watched that great documentary about her relatively recently and was not aware of her work before that. And you reproduce a self-portrait in here. And yeah, just tell us something about, you know, this idea of the photographer that, you know, has basically gone about a lifetime's work entirely unacknowledged.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the comparison I make is with literature, where, you know, the canon is pretty robust, really, you know, and occasionally we'll, you know, somebody gets allowed in who's been hitherto, you know, neglected or whatever, and there's a lot of that going on at the moment. But what is still a relatively rare event in literature is really, really common in photography. So a few years ago, of course, I mean, in that old duffer's way, I mean about 20 or more years ago, you know, I was involved in this thing whereby there was this photographer who'd been working away in America, William Gedney, died of AIDS, left his work to Lee Friedlander. And then I was involved in this project to hopefully get him sort of retrospectively inserted into the pantheon of really important American photographers, which we then did to a great degree. The thing about Gedney, though, okay, he dropped out of sight, but he was known at the time in the photographic world. Whereas Vivian Mayer is this person who, I mean, nobody knew that she was taking photographs. And it's more extreme than that. People seem to barely aware that she was even existed. People knew very little about her apart from the fact she was a governess. And then she produced, it was discovered, this great stash of work, which was so completely accomplished. And it wasn't just the thing that, there were a handful of really of striking pictures. There was this completely, you know, fully formed, stylistically unified body of work. And there it was, just this, just existing entirely in a contextual vacuum. So that piece I wrote came very well. It was actually the introduction which they asked me to write for the book that, was again hoping to, bring this work to light. But in this case, it exploded in such a way that then Vivian Maier became this kind of colossally important figure in her own right. And there was many subsequent books, as you rightly say, there was this film. But it's, as I say, it's one of the really interesting things, I think, about the history of photography. It's not just that you update each new edition of a history of photography by adding a kind of new chapter saying, work made since 2010 or whatever. You're always having to add these chapters into the middle to take account of these hitherto unknown people, particularly when it comes to people working in colour. Because as we know, the standard narrative version of things is that serious colour photography only got going with Eggleston in the early 70s with his show at MoMA in New York. But it's turning out that all this kind of colour work made before then is becoming known. And of course, in keeping with that, there's been a book published of Vivian Maier's colour work. So I think, although there's a lot of it about, she is the single most spectacular example of somebody who's been brought back from the dead, who's been exhumed in this way.
And you also contrast Vivian Maier with what's happened with Dennis Hopper's work. And this is someone who was obviously, colossally famous for something else, and also had a body of work of photography that was at one point well regarded and then sort of like disappeared and then came back, as it were. And it strikes me that this is not something that would happen now with a celebrity in the age of Instagram.
Yeah, that's right. Just to sort of correct things there, I think these are Hopper pictures that we're talking about. They did literally drop out of sight in the kind of, people lost, they reemerged somewhere. I think they got lost in the kind of chaos of Hopper's life and his death. And it's a strange thing, I think. On the one hand, maybe the work didn't receive its due because of the fact that it was by this celebrity. So we're used to, people having exhibitions of their paintings, not because the paintings are good, but because they're guitarists or whatever it is. But in Hopper's work, he was a serious photographer. And in any case, there is this complicating thing with photography, because as Gary Winogrand so profoundly said, if you take pictures in Texas a lot, then your pictures are going to look like Texas. And in the case of Dennis Hopper, because of the world he moved in, then some of these pictures are interesting because they're pictures not only of a bloke who happens to look very pretty, but because, that person's Paul Newman or that person is X or Y. So it is, the quality of his work is partly dependent on the society that he was completely a part of.
I wanted to talk next about your chapter on Fred Sigmund's motels in Vegas. While reading this, I was struck by, thinking of some other architectural photographers that I'm thinking particularly of and I've now completely forgotten his name, but the guy who took all of the photographs of the war memorials in former the Balkan states, and people that take photographs of brutalist buildings or whatever, and the idea of these photographs of these motels in Vegas that were sort of ephemeral buildings that were already in decline and now are mostly gone, and how that acts as not only great photographs of an interesting subject, but also as some sort of historical record.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you can never tell which particular buildings, which subject matter are going to acquire that particular kind of elegiac quality. But yeah, in the case of the Sigmund Motel pictures, they're really strong because I think that the allure of neon is so strong, and you've got that kind of thing of I don't know, you've got all that promise of romance. I mean, and it's the combination of that and the fact that it's past. And so, as was the case with that Ilse Bing image of Garbo, where I said, yeah, we seem to be getting here something contained in this photograph of the essence of photography. So with this idea of that you're documenting, you're recording something, and then it's there will come a time when the picture survives, but the thing that it's a picture of doesn't. Well, then, of course, the picture automatically is going to acquire a special resonance. So I think it's that idea of, yeah, preserved longing or preserved romance, something like that.
And I wanted to talk about the Andreas Gursky photograph that you reproduced in the book, the 99 Cent Store.
Oh, yeah.
Which, again, this is a photograph from 1999.
Yeah.
But has, and I know obviously when it's reproduced, when one sees this photograph in a gallery, it's an enormous photograph, which is one of the things that's sort of distinct about it, because it's a photograph that has obviously a huge amount of detail. But this is, I think, one of the photographs, and I keep bringing up the idea of Instagram, but it's one of the photographs that reminds me most of a photograph that one might see nowadays taken by somebody on Instagram. Beautiful photograph of a very mundane subject.
Yeah, and yes, so there's an irony there, but there's another irony, of course, in the title of it, 99 cents. So it's in one of these shops where everything goes for 99 cents. But I don't know what the current asking price for one of these Gurskys would be. Probably, I imagine, be not much short of $1 million, and it would be an addition of this is a picture of a store where, you know, everything is available in great multiple quantities. But by that, by the strict limiting of an edition of a picture of that size, you pump up the value. And of course, also, I mean, it's reproduced in my book, I don't know what size it is, 2.5 inches by 4 inches, something like that. But it's one of those pictures where the experience of seeing it huge in a gallery, where it's, I don't know what the exact dimensions would be, probably 20 feet by 6 feet, something like that. It's a completely sort of immersive experience. And typically for me, I mean, my main interest, my main way of looking at photographs is when they're in books. And, you know, I really love Gary Winogrand. And of course, it's nice to see them on a museum wall, but you don't lose too much of the experience by looking at them when they're reproduced, however poorly. And quite smallly in a book, whereas that Gursky experience, the experience of looking at a Gursky, is so bound up with its size, and it became possible technologically to do things on that scale at exactly the time that Gursky was doing these things. And I think it seems to me he's recording a particular sort of historical moment in perception, and there's all sorts of ways technically in which he does that. But what we get is a kind of this weird thing of two-dimensional immersion, as it were. You know, you can really lose yourself in a Gursky image. And also, it's one of these things that, you know, we've all seen places like that all the time. But I wonder, did we become much more conscious? Were these places somewhat invisible to us before Gursky brought them to our attention? Of course, they must have existed before he photographed them. Otherwise, he couldn't have photographed them. But we were in some way, I think, oblivious to them, maybe before he recorded them like that.
Just one more photograph then, and that's the photograph by Zoe Strauss, which is called Monique Showing Black Eye. And actually, I was more wanting to talk really about the fantastic way that Zoe Strauss first exhibited her photographs in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she's such a... You know, let's say she was a kind of neighborhood photographer in that. She had this great thing of exhibiting her photographs. I can't remember the exact place. Maybe, what is it, under the I-95 freeway.
I-95, yeah.
In Philadelphia. So the nice thing is that these were pictures of this particular place being shown not in the sort of exclusive confines of the V&A or the Museum of Modern Art or whatever, but in the environment that they were depicting, and therefore becoming a part of that environment and making it nicer and people could see themselves or all that kind of stuff. What struck me about Zoe Strauss generally, whose work I came across randomly when I visited actually the Museum of Modern Art in New York to see something else where there was this retrospective of her work going on. So she's a very, very, it's this paradox, I guess, that I like so much, whereby, she's a very, very distinctive individual voice or pair of eyes, whatever you want to call it. But as you look at it, you can see how that distinctiveness is actually enhanced when you see it in the larger tradition of American photography. So I think, you know, there are all sorts of echoes of, say, Walker Evans and other photographers. And since you've mentioned this one of the black eye, Monique with a black eye, I think it's, you know, immediately you see that picture, you also think of the famous picture by Mangoldin of, you know, of herself with a black eye after she's been beaten. So I think maybe it's because I don't know why it is, but I'm always very, very interested in the way that in an individual photograph, quite often you can see the larger tradition of photography that has led to it. And that, of course, that doesn't diminish a picture's originality. It just refines our sense of its originality, if you like.
And just to finish off, the last essay in this book is about John Berger, who you mentioned earlier on, and the influence that he had on yourself as a writer and I guess a looker. Yeah, just tell us something about that. Tell us something about the particular influence that John Berger had on yourself and your work.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was huge, really. I wouldn't have become a writer were it not for the influence of John Berger's books. Because at that time, when I left university in 1980, you know, there was two ways of being a writer. You were either a novelist or you were a critic, which meant you wrote about other people's books. And Berger offered this possibility of somewhere in between, whereby you could be a cultural commentator and also a creative writer. You could be a writer of something that was very original, but was also a form of commentary. And also with Berger, there's this thing of endless formal innovation. I mean, the way that he kept trying to find forms that were that was uniquely appropriate to the subject he was addressing. And I found he was the first person I read, to put it crudely, who made these sort of boring old pictures, paintings of men in ruffs or whatever, you know, in a museum look really interesting. So I guess he really opened my eyes, and it was through him that I really became properly interested in looking at paintings, looking at photographs. And stylistically, his influence as a writer on me was considerable. I'm not sure it is so considerable now. And then the other thing that was so crucial is that we all hear these stories of people who meet the writer that they idolize, or the artist that they idolize, and then it turns out this idol has feet of clay. Whereas Berger, who was the first great writer I met, turned out to be such a wonderful man, such an exemplary man who set such a sort of standard of behavior, and who then, you know, was the best thing of all. You know, we became friends, and it was just been one of the defining relationships of my adult life, I think.
So I've been talking to Jeff Dyer. We've been talking about his new book, Seesaw, Looking at Photographs, which is out now from Canongate. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Oh, thank you, Neil. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.